This is the World Retail Podcast, the premier platform for global retail leaders, where vision meets insight and innovation takes center stage. From AI to embedded finance, leadership to the ever-evolving consumer, we bring you the voices shaping the future of retail. World Retail Podcast, your front row seat to retail's next chapter.
Hello and welcome to the World Retail Podcast, brought to you by the World Retail Congress. My name is Ian McGarrigle and I am the founder and chair of the World Retail Congress. This episode is part of a special series called Retail Leadership Voices, which I'm delighted to be co-hosting with the global team from the executive search firm Spencer Stuart Associates. This series will bring you high-level interviews with some top retail leaders to learn more about their career journey, their perspective on what it means to be a leader in retailing today, their thoughts on the industry, and above all, we will try and find out more about them on a personal level. Today's interview was with Michael Medline, the president and CEO of Empire Company, one of Canada's largest retailers and grocers, including Sobeys. Michael joined Empire as president and CEO in 2017 from another major retailer, Canadian Tire Company, and undertook a massive restructuring and transformation program. I was joined for this special interview by Carter Powis, Spencer Stuart's Head of Retail, Consumer and Marketing in Canada. I very much hope you enjoy this episode with Carter and I in conversation with Michael Medline. Hello, Carter. Thank you for joining me for this special interview as part of the World Retail Leadership Voices for the World Retail Podcast. How are you today?
I'm well, Ian. Thank you so much. I'm really pleased to be here and looking forward to our conversation with Michael. I think what makes this story so compelling is that when Michael joined Empire in January of 2017, the company was really struggling. 3 weeks prior to his start date, Empire announced its quarterly results. And in that announcement, it said its profits had dropped 70%, its revenue was down over 2%, and its stock was trading at a five-year low. Michael was hired to transform the business, and he and his team have done just that. Over the last 8 years, revenue has increased from approximately $24 billion to $31 billion. The stock price has grown from $15.75 to yesterday's close of $49.68. And the company announced record quarterly profits earlier this month. And they've done this during one of the most tumultuous times for food retailing and retailing in general, perhaps ever. It's a really interesting story, and I'm excited to hear what Michael has to say. So back to you.
Thanks, Carter. And as I say, there's going to be lots to talk about. I'm looking forward to it. And without further ado, Michael, great to welcome you to the World Retail Podcast. How are you today?
It's good to be here, and thanks for asking me to do this. I'm sure you had way better candidates, and they must have turned you down. But I also wanted to thank Spencer Stuart, because one of the reasons I'm in this job is because of Spencer Stuart doing a search for Empire Company, and that's how I ended up here. And Spencer Stuart has been integral to our success by placing so many of our senior executives since 2017 here at Empire, and it has helped us turn around the company. So I wanted to thank the firm.
Yeah, and that turnaround, as Carter said, is quite extraordinary. So, but really, before we sort of dive in, Michael, for our listeners that maybe don't know Empire Company, would love it if you could maybe give us a quick introduction to the business. It is quite some scale, and there's quite a brand portfolio as well.
Yeah, the company is over 100 years old. It was founded in Stellarton, Nova Scotia, by J.W. Sobey and his son, Frank H. Sobey, Frank H. Sobey was a business genius. And he went about starting with one store in Stellarton, and we now have 1,800 sites across the country, 129,000 teammates, which makes us the second largest employer in the country. And we grew both organically, but also through many acquisitions and mergers. And so it's a really interesting company. We have a mix of corporate stores and franchise stores. We have a mixture of union and no union. So it's a complex business, but it's been able to prosper, as I said, for over 100 years.
Great. Thanks, Michael. Carter, over to you.
Michael, there was a line in your retirement announcement that really kind of stuck out for me. And it's, quote, you said, "There is never a perfect time to retire from a job that you love." Why has this job been so meaningful and special for you?
Well, I had never taken on a challenge quite like this one. And I'd gone to school and I had plenty of jobs throughout my career. But I'd never taken on anything that was so important. And it was important because of 129,000 teammates that I just mentioned, and their families who relied on Empire for their livelihood. And because I had long been a fan of the Sobey family, and it was a down time for Sobeys, and I expect for the Sobey family. And so the fact that there was so much pressure, because this could have gone a different way, and because there was so much pressure and because of how hard the team had to work to effect this turnaround, it became very meaningful and very personal for me. And so I'll always carry that with me when I leave the company. I'll always have a very special place in my heart and be cheering them on, because there's just so much history and so many people relied on it, and we had to do so many things to make it successful.
Michael, you've talked already a lot about teams and people in the business. When you first joined, you built your own team, but yeah, as you say, there's 129,000 teammates. What do you think about the important qualities of what makes a good team, and has that definition changed in your time in leadership roles?
Yeah, I came into the job thinking I knew a lot about teams, and I think that I was pretty well right, and it just became underscored for me that the two things I look for are, and I think back to that book on Lincoln, Team of Rivals, by Doris Kearns Goodwin, that you don't want a bunch of people who are the same. You want different perspectives. And you want very different perspectives from yourself, because I already know what I think. I want to hear what other people think and listen to that. And that's what we were able to put together here, was a team that came from different places and brought different perspectives that made it ultimately a great team. And I also wanted people who would cause a little bit of friction. And so you've got people coming from different places who will speak their mind. And I've got a few in particular in my head right now of who will tell you whatever's on their mind. And that turned out to make a great team. As I say to them, though, there are 10 days a year. I wish I had a team that just thought like me and weren't so transparent. But for about 355 days a year, I am so glad to have a team like this. And that has made it a better company, that we challenged each other, that they challenged me, and they challenged themselves. And so, but that took a little time, right? You can't do that all overnight. So there's a lot of change over the first year or two to put in place a team which really worked together well.
Michael, we talked earlier in this just about the impact of the transformation that you've led, the impact it's had on the company. What have you taken away from that experience in terms of transforming the business? How did overseeing that impact your approach as a CEO?
Yeah, I think that it really has impacted the way I think of things. I know CEOs always say you got to go fast, and I always use the word velocity, but you actually, at the beginning of this, you cannot go fast enough. You're going full out 24/7 to try to transform the company, and the quicker you're moving, the better. And you have to make very, very bold decisions with not 100% of the data in. And you have to be comfortable with making decisions with 80, 90%, or you will slow down the whole transformation. But the thing I learned the most from it was that you have to be open and transparent and true. And people can handle the truth. And what they can't handle is if they feel that you're obfuscating, if you're hiding things, if you have another agenda. So basically from the first day, I was out there telling people that change had to come. It was going to be painful, that maybe not everyone was, unfortunately, they were good people, but because of the leadership and some of the strategy, not everyone was going to be able to make the whole journey. And the more that we shared, the more the team across the whole country responded. And so I'm a big believer that in trusting people and being as open as you possibly can. That really impacted me.
Yeah. And Michael, you referenced earlier that the business grew on a lot of acquisitions in its history, and it's been no different under your leadership. And I think was it you acquired Farm Boy in 2018, Longo's in 2021. So acquisitions and bringing new businesses into a company is not an easy thing to do. I mean, what have been your sort of lessons of how you navigate that process? How do you bring a business and acquisition into a bigger company?
Yeah, I've long been a big believer, because I came from a certain background doing, after I was a lawyer, I try to hide the fact that I was a lawyer, but that night I did investor relations, I did strategy, I did M&A, did all the sorts of corporate development. I'm a big believer that you have to be growing your business organically, but that cannot be enough, that you have to make inorganic transactions to really jump your growth. And I did that as a teammate at Canadian Tire, and then as a leader at Canadian Tire. And that really impacted me in terms of how you could really get going by bringing in these inorganic acquisitions or mergers. And now looking back here too, I came into this job and I said in my interview, although part of the reason I got the job was a botched integration of a pretty good acquisition, that we would again acquire and partner. And we did. And now looking back, you mentioned it was, you know, it's 2018. We did the first one. It's kind of insane, actually, how, like looking back on that, that was during the transformation. We still were able to convince the most attractive partner, Farm Boy, in the country to join with us, and that the board would be bold enough to embark on that journey, which has worked out so well, as has the great Longo's acquisition. There's rules I have, though, and look, I come from that background, so I'm always looking at the economics and the financials of these deals. But I've learned over my career, having seen more than my share of good ones, but also a few bad ones, is it all comes down to culture and fit. And that if you're trying to partner, merge, acquire a company where it's not going to be a fit, it will be a disaster. And so a lot of time was spent on these, on all my last four acquisitions, Canadian Tire and then Farm Boy and Longo's, in really assessing the fit, to the extent that in both Farm Boy and Longo's, I tried to convince them not to sell to us, that they'd be happier being on their own, that it was going to be difficult to be part of a big company, and that and just to make sure that they came in eyes wide open to what was going to happen. In fact, they later gave me a bit of heck that I'd undersold how good it would be, but I find that when you're hiring executives or you're trying to do these sort of things, it's better to put all the stuff on the table, as ugly as it may be, so that everyone knows what's happening. But culture all day long. I'm fine with overpaying by a little bit, because in the sands of time, a good deal is so great for a company. And in this case, both of these smaller retailers have brought more to us than we've brought to them. So it's culture, and then having the open mind that you don't have all the answers. And just because you're bigger, it certainly doesn't mean you have all the answers. And so we've got so much from these great companies and people.
Yeah.
Michael, you've over the years in the presentations of yours that I've heard, in the analyst calls, in your press release announcing your planned retirement, you refer to your employees as teammates. And I know that's very important to you. How has that impacted the culture of the organization in terms of treating colleagues, employees equally as one big team? What impact has that had on the culture of the organization?
Yeah, you know, I do things my way, and I don't judge people who call people employees or anything like that. But for me, I found it the wrong term, that I'm part of a team. And in Canada, we talk about hockey teams, and everybody has their role to play on the team. And my role happens to be here, the CEO. But there are people across this country who work as butchers, who work stocking shelves, who work in a supply chain, who are so important to making sure that the customer is thrilled and that we do well, and that all of us together can be successful. And it just felt wrong to me. And I started doing this at Canadian Tire a little bit. And then here, I don't think I've used the word employee once in my 9 years to describe anyone at this company, because they are either my colleagues and especially my teammates. And I say that all the time because I mean it, that we all got to work together in our different roles. And sometimes you wonder whether this has, so I started doing it and I didn't stop doing it. But then sometimes I go, is this having any impact on the company? Like, is anyone noticing that we do this? And then once in a while, you get a resounding yes, that these things you do, if you're consistent with them and you really believe in them, like I do resonate. We were giving awards to our best store teammates a few weeks ago, and this was in Atlantic Canada. And one of the winners came up to me and said that they were so upset at how the company was doing and were thinking of going somewhere else when I joined. And then that they heard me on some media talking about teammates, and that it wasn't just internal, I was talking external. And they said it changed the way they thought, and that they were willing to give us a chance. And I've heard that some times before. And every time I hear it, I told the person how gratifying that is, because I really believe it. But sometimes you think no one's listening. But I think if you believe in something and you keep doing it and you're true, it has a big impact. And it doesn't have to be teammates. It can be all sorts of other ways you can do that. And I know a lot of great CEOs and leaders who have their own ways of doing it.
Let's expand on that culture piece for a minute, Michael, because I think it's a very interesting component of this transformation that you've driven. At Spencer Stuart, as you know, we firmly believe that it's people and talent that power an organization, with the CEO setting the tone. Talk a bit about that culture shift that you've driven from the organization that was struggling to an organization that's doing well. There's been a fairly significant change over the last 8 or 9 years. Talk a little bit about that and how you've done that.
Yeah, I remember, and you might have actually been there, Carter, because you were part of that search, but I gave a presentation to the board on when I had to present to see if they wanted me. And I said that I was not going to try to change the culture of a company that had been so successful over 100 years, and how possibly could I do that? Because I was asked, what are you going to do to change the culture? I said, not only can I not do it and I'll be unsuccessful, I don't want to do it, because everything I knew about the culture was fine. And I thought that most of the people were great. And so then what does that mean, though? Then how do you transform a company if you think the culture is right? It came down to two things. One was accentuating different parts of the culture that I thought had become a bit lost or misinterpreted. And really emphasizing that we had to turn up different parts of it. And so there were great things in our company, but the attention to being results oriented had been lost somewhere along the way. And so things like that was really started to, but this had been a really results-oriented culture. So where did we go wrong? And so while understanding the culture and the values of the company, I was able to operate within those, yet transform us into a very successful company. And I would say that at very few companies or places, unless they've gone extremely wrong, have a bad culture. It's not how they wouldn't have been successful over any period of time. And so I think if you come in and you go, I'm going to change the culture, I'm going to change the values, wow, you're set for failure. And I would not say that you should do that except in dire circumstances. And I was convinced that the culture and the people were strong and that it was a crisis of leadership.
Michael, thinking about your time as leader at Empire Company, you know, you had this massive role to do, as you said, of turning the company around, but you also had to face two extraordinary existential issues, a global pandemic, and I think the highest inflation for four decades in Canada. I mean, how did you face into that as a leader? And did you, you know, how could you possibly feel prepared, or did you feel prepared with, did your experience put you in good stead to be able to cope with those massive issues?
Yeah, well, I get the answer is I'd never seen anything like it. And it was almost like four years of just pure craziness and doing things that we never really had to do before in such a way. The way I looked at it was that even though we hadn't faced a global pandemic, even though we had not, no, and I used to talk about inflation and say, it's going to happen one day. Hope it doesn't happen on my watch. Because, and we haven't had it happen in four decades. So no one in management or on a board has any clue what to do in these circumstances or what will happen. Even though you haven't faced it, you face things like it. And that you've been hopefully educated and have had hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of experiences, which can add up to how to adapt to new situations. And that's what happened. And I think the first thing that, I talked to my two chief concierge here, including the head of HR and our chief development officer. And what we concluded right away was no matter what happens, because it's uncharted territory, stick to the culture and values. If we stick to the values, so we will be okay and we'll get through this. If we treat our customers respectfully, we don't take advantage of a situation, if we do everything we can to protect our teammates. So we, and every decision, especially in the pandemic, was made with that in mind, not how much it would cost, not what it would do to those quarterly earnings, but doing the right thing by customers and teammates, the Empire way. That really worked well. And then, you know, you start feeling sorry a little, oh, how come I had to go through this? But I took a different perspective after a few days, which was I kind of felt bad for leaders who either came before or will come after, because this was the true test of what your team would have to measure up to. And that's what, you know, years from now, if we bump into each other, that's what we'll talk about, would be those crazy hard times, not the great days when your stock hits all-time highs and all. That's not what you're probably going to talk about. Inflation was a totally different animal, as I knew it would be. What I think that leaders across the world, so you've got, this is going to people across all your offices. I think in every single country, the political and media reaction to inflation was very anti-company, anti-capitalist in some ways, and that somehow little old Empire Company was causing global inflation. And you know, in retrospect, I can kind of understand why people were using that. But I think that was the most frustrating period for our team, as we were doing everything we could to keep prices down for our customers, that we were being accused of raising prices in what hopefully will be the highest inflation for some time to come. That was very, very difficult and took patience. And maybe a couple times I lost a little patience, but we were called into Parliament. We were being vilified in the media. And you know, there's sometimes you deserve it, and this time we did not deserve it. So that was, in a weird way, very, very difficult.
Yeah. Just thinking back to the global pandemic, are there some lessons of leadership that have stayed with you? I mean, a lot of people talk about the need to act quickly, make big, bold decisions. There was no time to sort of think this. Do you think some things have stayed with you?
Yeah, and I'm a little disappointed, because I thought during, you know, when you're working on, let's say, an acquisition, or you're working on the something like the pandemic, you're moving really fast with not all the information. And you're just making decisions, like I said, which take care of your customers and your teammates. And then it seems like it's impossible to keep that pace up. And I'm trying to drive velocity and boldness in the company, but it almost takes a crisis to bring out how good you can be in that. And then you have to remind people, we've done this before. We're good when we're bold. We're good when we make decisions. We're not so good when we could become gun shy. And I think that that's what I think about. I think about making all the decisions for the right reason still, but how do we do things much faster? And you can lose that velocity very quickly. And people were tired after the pandemic. They were worn out. And so you had to get them back up and going again.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you did do and have done through your tenure as CEO, Michael, is you've taken on a bit of an industry leadership role. During the pandemic, you were fast out of the gate, one of the first to install plexiglass. You were one of the first to incorporate extra bonuses for your frontline staff. You also drove the creation of the industry-wide grocery code of conduct, which has now been signed by all the major players. Why was that important for you to influence the broader industry and have impact beyond Empire?
Well, I do think it's part of the job as a leader to stand up for your company. And also then, if you think there's something going on in the industry that you can, that it could do better, to say something. And, you know, there's a bunch of different examples of that I can call on, but I think you raised two good ones. If plexiglass one was really interesting. So no one in North America had yet put up plexiglass. And I remember getting up and the call was across the world with a bunch of retailers. There were about 10 retailers on the call from all over the world, Asia, Europe, Latin America and North America. And we were discussing what every country was facing. A lot of countries were ahead of us, unfortunately for them, in terms of the pandemic really hitting them hard before it came to Canada. And so, but I really wanted to hear what other people were doing because you felt a compulsion to keep everyone safe, obviously. I'm on this call and I didn't have a very good connection. And there was a retailer from Italy. And they said that I thought they had said something about putting plexiglass up, but I couldn't understand. So I texted someone else who was on the call and said, did he just say plexiglass? And he said, yeah, they're putting it up there. And so while still on the call, I made the decision to, without knowing how we're going to do it or how much it was going to cost, I gave the decision while still on that call to corner the market on plexiglass and get it up in our stores. The next day, we had the first three stores piloted. We did the majority of our stores in the first week, and we completed all of our stores in the first 2 weeks. I think most of them in the first 2 weeks. And it felt good to do something which kept, I mean, our teammates were coming to work. They weren't getting to stay at home, and they were being exposed to the coronavirus more than anyone. And we were an essential service. And what it showed me, again, was if you just make a decision, let your teams do it. They'll figure out, our real estate team, our store teams, they figured out how to do it. And it was, weirdly enough, plexiglass will be one of the things I'm most proud of, which I never thought I would say. And then with the code of conduct, I know, and you know, some of your clients in the UK and some of the other countries had code of conducts. I came to this industry from the hard goods and soft goods side. And I could not believe how poor the relationships between retailers and our partners, I call them supplier partners, again, a term I use, were. And I learned, I kept an open mind, and I heard that if there was a code of conduct, it would treat supplier partners better. And I went and I fought for that. And our team fought for that for 2 years. And we now have in Canada a code of conduct, which will bring fairness and improve the partnership with our suppliers. And that's really, really important to me. And I took a bit of a beating from some of my fellow grocery CEOs. But in the end, I think everyone came on board, and I think it'll be a better industry. And once in a while, you got to break from the pack if you think something's the thing to do. You got to do the right thing, and you can't worry about what they're going to say about you. You've just got to do it. And then if you believe in it, and that's sort of how I've governed myself. But I do think that it's a little unusual in retail, but I think you have to stand up for your industry. If the industry's hurting, you will hurt. And the customers will be hurt.
Michael, you've been the CEO now of two iconic Canadian retailers. With the benefit of hindsight, what would you tell your younger self as you started out on your CEO journey?
Well, there's a lot, but because I had a lot of things to improve upon, like everyone does. And you look back and you realize how you can educate yourself, you can work hard. It's experience and seeing things a lot, many times over, really helps you. I'd say the thing I would tell my younger self, and I say it to groups of younger people a lot, is by the time I was 25 or 26, I wanted to be a public company CEO. And I guess it's good to have goals. And for me, it turned out okay. But I was too driven to that and in some ways too ambitious. And I think I could have, what I tell people is, if you're at a good company and you have a good job, enjoy it. Enjoy that. And you will be better. And it wasn't until I was 40 that I realized that I have a good job. I'm at a good company and start enjoying it. And actually, I became a better leader and probably wouldn't be here today unless I'd finally realized that I was thinking too much about myself rather than the team. And I was not enjoying the great jobs I had, because I'd get the job and then then 3 weeks later, I'd go, oh, that's it. What am I going to get next? And that's a horrible way to live. And it's not a good way to lead. And I could have been better that way. But thank God I realized it after like 13, 14 years of this. And that's the advice I give people is I tell people just enjoy what you're doing and good things should happen. And by the way, if you're doing a good job and they're not giving you breaks, leave. Get out of there. Go to see Spencer Stewart and get a better job where they'll appreciate you. And that's my number one piece of advice I give my children. I give anyone who asks for advice. And I try not to be the old guy who gives tons of advice, but if asked, that would be my recommendation.
Michael, in addition to your CEO roles, you've also had a number of board roles over the years. You currently sit on the board of Bank of Nova Scotia, which is one of Canada's largest banks. You've also sat on a number of well-respected not-for-profits. So just spend a second talking about how these outside experiences have helped you in your current position.
Yeah, I think it's one of the most important things that I've done to make myself a better leader. And I didn't really fully expect that, but at a certain age you're not going to school, people aren't being as honest about you and giving you the feedback they should maybe, and so you need other ways to learn and judge yourself. And I have found that being on the Bank of Nova Scotia board or the Sick Kids board or the other boards that I'm on, that I am seeing life from a different perspective. I'm seeing it from a director's perspective. And because of that, I can be a better leader and hopefully interact with my own board better. I have seen CEOs and senior leaders who do things that I would not see otherwise, because you can grab breakfast with someone. They don't show you exactly what they do. They can't do that. I got to see things from great leaders at these boards where I go, wow, why aren't I doing that? I should be doing that more, or why isn't my company doing that? Or we got to be more transparent in this area, or talk to our board differently. I think you're just seeing the inner workings of a company. It's like almost cheating in your own job. So although you should be bringing a lot of value to these boards that you're on, you're getting a ton of value back. In fact, to the extent that I think a lot of CEOs and boards have it wrong, that they should be, they're worried that that their leaders will become distracted on these boards. I encourage our leaders and our young executives especially to try to get on a board And it doesn't have to be, I think there's great philanthropic boards where you can learn a lot. Get on a for-profit or not-for-profit, and you will be a better leader. And so I think it's a great training ground. Instead, people see it as a distraction. I think they're wrong, and I've come to that conclusion.
Michael, that's what you're saying there. It's like a constant learning in leadership role. So think about when you were CEO at Canadian Tire and where you are now as president and CEO of Empire Company. How has your leadership style evolved? How have you evolved as a leader, would you say?
Yeah. So remember, since I was like relatively young, I wanted to be a CEO. But I think I had the wrong idea of what a CEO was like. You think that CEO is like this all powerful job where, you know, like you can basically do whatever you want. And you know, everyone who's listening to this would laugh because obviously that's just not the case. The special relationship you have is with the board and especially the chair of the board. And they're, you know, and I used to always say, oh, as CEO, you don't really have a boss, you have a board. No, you have a boss. And it's the board, and it's exemplified by the chair of the board, and you should act like that. And so I realized that I could do more to have a better relationship with the chairs of the board. And so when I came onto Empire, and I have a great chair of the board here, Jim Dixon, he and I just had a wonderful relationship, which was right. He was the board member and a chair, and I was, you know, management, and we kept it that way. But I asked him at the beginning, and we kept to it about 90% of the time. Every Friday, we would formally talk and just share things about what we see, what's going on, for an hour. And even if we didn't have anything on the agenda, we talked for an hour. And then in between, we'd obviously talk. But I think what I learned was how important relationships are. And the relationship with the board I mentioned, but also that your relationship with your executive team and how much you count on them and have to count on them. And that if you don't have trust in someone on your executive team, you're going to have to part ways. You've got to have that trust in them. And so I learned a lot there in terms of being, you know, I think I was a good CEO at Canadian Tire, but I don't think I was great. And I don't think it's possible unless you're really a special person. I have some friends who are special and they were good right away. It's almost like training wheels the first couple of years as you're, and board should realize that too, as you make mistakes, as you're learning. So it was almost cheating here at Empire because I'd already had some time as a CEO at a different company. So I came in with more mature viewpoint of how to interact with boards and interact with people, and also how important it is. And I cannot overemphasize it, to have relationships outside of the company, to learn from people. Every time I've met with people, I always talk about breakfast because I like having breakfast with people. I learn something, and it's a relationship that I get a lot out of, both professionally and personally. And sometimes you go, oh man, I got to go to another breakfast. Why did I do that? And every single time you go afterward, that's why I do it. Because boy, was that interesting what they said about brands? Is that interesting what they said about leadership? And you can share, especially with other CEOs, they know what you're going through and you need that outlet. People ask me, is it a lonely job? It is not a lonely job. You've got tons of people around you. It's only a lonely job if you make it so.
So Michael, we've got something we refer to as the quick fire quiz. It's just some short questions. Ian and I are going to fire at you. So,
yeah, I'm terrible with short answers.
Well, that's okay. Well, do your best. Okay. So first one, what's the one subject you'd like to learn more about?
Well, I got a bad answer, which is AI, because I'm trying to learn everything I can. That's not a good answer. But the really good answer is that during COVID, my youngest daughter really got into birding and became, like, she is really good to the extent that to commemorate a special occasion, we went together to Costa Rica, and I'd never gone birding. And I was blown away, first of all, by her expertise, but also I found it really interesting and quite zen-like. And so I would like to learn more about birds, but I will never have the patience that my daughter does to stand there like she does and learn so much. But that is a topic I would like to learn more about.
Okay. What gives you confidence?
My family and a good team at work.
What's a great lesson a mentor or maybe a former boss has taught you, Michael?
Yeah, my former mentor who passed away used to say, make people your partner, not your judge. And don't involve people in decisions. Don't just come to them and make them decide. And I've tried to do that as much as I can. I failed sometimes, but I try to do it.
What book are you currently reading?
Yeah, I try not to read business books because I used to know some executives and they would switch their behavior all the time depending on what book they were reading. So I stopped. I wouldn't read it. I am currently rereading Steinbeck's East of Eden. I love reading fiction. It's a way for me to unwind. And it's good. It's good for me. It gives me, I don't know why, I come up with good ideas sometimes after I'm reading.
Michael, what in your experience is one city that travelers should visit?
Yeah, there's so many great cities around the world, and a lot of you have offices everywhere. But I think a gem is Halifax, Nova Scotia, and because I joined Sobeys and I got to Nova Scotia so much. Halifax is the most incredible city, and you can drive to so many beautiful places and interesting places. So if you haven't been to Halifax, I would encourage it.
What qualities do you most value in people?
Trustworthiness and results-orientedness.
Okay. And when you're not working, Michael, how do you spend your time?
Yeah, I'm a sports nut. I cheer for all the Toronto teams. And that can be sometimes great and sometimes quite painful. And I like golf and tennis. But anything, the games are good because I go with my kids. And that's a good time to spend with your children.
And Michael, our last question, what's the one thing you're most excited about over the next 12 months?
I'm always excited about the next 12 months, but the next one is interesting because it'll be something different is going to happen to me. And I've been, not that there's a dull day at Empire, but you do get used to a place, and sometimes change, although daunting and although I loved it so much here, change can be exciting as well. So not knowing exactly what I'm going to be doing when I leave this place is exciting in a way.
Well, very much look forward to hearing what that next chapter will be for you, Michael. But we've run out of time, and I just really want to say a big thank you, Michael. It's been a great interview and conversation. It's been great to hear more about you and the Empire Company and your career. So, and thank you, Carter, too.
Thank you, Ian. It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Michael.
Yeah, it was great. Great questions, and thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you again. Thanks very much. Thank you for listening to this episode of the World Retail Podcast, part of our special series called Retail Leadership Voices, brought to you in partnership with the global team from the executive search firm Spencer Stuart Associates. We hope today's conversation gave you valuable insights into retail leadership through the experience of a proven leader. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, and don't forget to leave us a review. It really helps others find the show. To stay up to date with the latest from the World Retail Congress and to access more exclusive content, visit us at www.worldretailcongress.com and follow us on LinkedIn. We'll be back soon with more thought-provoking discussions from the front lines of retail. Until then, thanks for listening.